Hosseinia, known as Jinnah Ghufran Ma'ab. He passed away with them, buried over there, and a commemoration session and gathering was held for him in Iraq, in Atabat. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Amin Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, mainly known as Mir Hamid Hussein Hindi, known by his book, Abaqatul Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimat al-Athar. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi Aman Allah.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced, as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. J. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil, missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghaleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation, and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets, with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akla, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this. But I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. the painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, helping the weak neighbors and meeting their needs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of helping the weak neighbors and meeting their needs as per the rights of the neighbors. When we look at the Islamic texts, we see clearly that Islam gives importance to the neighbors, and the giving importance to the rights of the neighbors is one of the main issues in the Islam, which Islam talks about, and it emphasizes of the rights about the rights of the neighbors. Therefore, in the rights of the neighbors, the first two things that we need to look after is that if there is a neighbor who is weak and he needs our help, we must help him. Now, this being weak means like he can be physically weak, or maybe he can be as per like in the terms of monetary, he is weak and he is poor. So therefore, when we are living in a society, when we are living in a place, in a street, we must look after our neighbors, we must have relations with our neighbors. But the main issue is how to help them when we do not know our neighbors. Unfortunately, the society in which we are living, it is going to a place where the neighbors, they don't know about each other. Everyone is living their own life. And because of this, we are unaware of our neighbors. We are unaware of their needs. We are unaware of their physical health. And this thing is not good at all, because this brings farness between the people and it does not bring love amongst the people. Therefore, we need to be careful in this matter, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of helping the weak neighbors and meeting their needs. And in this we said that, unfortunately, the society in which we are living, this society is in a way that we are unaware of our neighbors. Therefore, when Islam says that the first right of the neighbors is to meet their needs, the first right of neighbor is to help the weak neighbors. Therefore, there is something which comes as a necessity, and that is you must have relation with your neighbors. You must go and meet your neighbors. You must be aware of your neighbors. And if we are aware of our neighbors, then in that case, we will know whether do they need our help or not. Therefore, it is necessary that amongst our neighborhood, if there are some people who are weak, who are maybe disabled, or maybe they need our help and they cannot do something specific, and in that matter, we are helpful and or we can help them, therefore, we need to struggle, we need to help them. And on top of that, we must meet their needs if they have any kind of need. If there are poor neighbors who do not even have something to eat, then obviously we need to help them. Maybe there is a neighbor who is in need of a loan, a specific loan for his children's education, maybe for his house or for his health matters. Therefore, we must help them generously, and in this way we will be following the teachings of Islam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. In the US, Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Shooting Was Not a Random Act of Violence." the U.S. Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. On Saturday, 14th of May, a gunman who said he was motivated by a version of this so-called replacement theory killed 10 people at a Buffalo, New York grocery store, according to officials. The suspect, identified as Peyton S. Gendron, wrote in an online diatribe that he sought to kill black people because he wanted to prevent white people from losing their rightful control of the country. Peyton Gendron described himself as part of a movement. He said that he was inspired by similar attacks on other minority communities and that he hoped others would follow his example. The suspects in several mass killings in recent years, including the 2015 murder of 9 black worshippers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, the 2018 murder of 11 Jewish worshippers at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the 2019 murder of 51 Muslim worshippers at a pair of mosques in New Zealand, and the 2019 murder of 23 people, many of them Latinos, in El Paso, Texas, also propounded versions of this racist worldview. American life is punctuated by mass shooting incidents that are routinely described as idiosyncratic. But these attacks are not random acts of violence. They are part of a long American history of political violence perpetrated by white supremacists against black people and other minority groups. Politicians who have employed some of the vocabulary of replacement theory generally do not make explicit calls for violence. The office of one of those politicians, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, said in a statement that the Buffalo attack was an act of evil and that she has never advocated for any racist position. But the matter is not so simple. Replacement theory is an attack on democracy. It privileges the purported interests of some Americans over those of others, asserting, in effect, that the will of the people means the will of white people. It rekindles fears and resentments among white Americans that cynical practitioners of American politics have stoked throughout the nation's history. It also provides a disturbing rationalization for people inclined to resort to violence when the political process does not deliver what they want or protect what they see as their place in society. The Fox News Channel host, Tucker Carlson, a leading purveyor of replacement theory rhetoric, has promoted the idea that elites are seeking to replace white Americans on more than 400 episodes of his program on Fox News Channel, according to an analysis by the New York Times. Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots with new people, more obedient voters from the third world, Tucker Carlson said on an episode in April of 2021. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, later tweeted that Tucker Carlson is correct about replacement theory as he explains what is happening in America. In September, Elise Stefanik's re-election campaign paid for a Facebook advertisement that combined imagery of immigrants with the accusation that radical Democrats are planning their most aggressive move yet, a permanent election insurrection. Ali Stefanik's advertisement continued. Their plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants will overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Right-wing rhetoricians in the United States portray undocumented immigrants as the primary threat. This sanitizes replacement theory for mainstream consumption without diluting its logic. The same argument is easily applied to other minority groups in the United States. The French author Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement in a 2011 book to describe what he saw as a conscious effort by French elite to open the country's doors for Muslim immigrants to replace the ethnically French population and French culture. The template has been adapted for use by extremists around the world. Mr. Gendron wrote that he blamed Jews for orchestrating the replacement of white Americans. He copied large portions of his manifesto from the document posted to justify the New Zealand killings, in some cases inserting the name of Jewish businessman George Soros in place of the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel's name. The manifesto posted by the El Paso shooting suspect, which Mr. Gendron also referenced, spoke of the Hispanic invasion of Texas. The common thread, the ineluctable core of replacement theory, is that some people are white and some people are not, and that the people who are white are threatened by those who are not. It must also be emphasized that the United States makes it easy for domestic terrorists to kill. The police said that the Buffalo assailant used a Bushmaster XM-15 rifle that he had purchased legally at a gun shop near his hometown. As a practical matter, almost anyone can buy guns that are designed to kill a lot of people quickly. The only real line of defense is the judgment of the people who sell guns. He didn't stand out, because if he did, I would have never sold him the gun, Robert Donald, the store's owner, told the New York Times. The focus on the gunman's motive should not obscure the fact that the most important step the government can take to impede similar attacks is to limit the availability of guns in the United States. The health of American democracy also requires the constructive use of free speech, especially by the nation's political leaders. There are always demagogues whose stock in trade is the demonization of immigrants and other minority groups. And American society has long allowed those on the fringes to air their views. The question in any era is whether such views are voiced or echoed by those in positions of responsibility. It is telling that House Republicans last year installed Ali Stefanik in leadership to replace Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who remains among the most forthright critics of the Republican Party's illiberal turn. Liz Cheney tweeted on Monday, "The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them." And Liz Cheney is certainly right.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic.
I wish to raise some concluding points. Dear brothers, dear sisters, the opportunity of having a responsibility is very fleeting and it will soon come to an end. Therefore, you must appreciate the value of this opportunity. You must use every hour of it. The second word of advice is that you should not work for the purpose of a show. You should not think of working for the sake of being seen by the people who have elected you or the people who watch you on television. This will spoil the blessedness of your work. If you think of doing something to make the people like you and you do not think of the significance of the task and of divine satisfaction, the blessedness of your work will be gone, and on many occasions you will not achieve any result either. The third issue is the conflict of interest. I see that the term conflict of interest is frequently used in the majlis, in the parliament. The conflict of interest does not only exist in the economy. These conflicts exist in other areas as well. If we have some interest in the people's attention to us, and if another interest is the public interest of the country, here too there is a conflict of interest. Which one do you prioritize? If we prioritize our reputation and the people's attention to us over the interests of the country, this is an example of conflict of interest. We must take God into account. This is another issue.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Majlis, the parliament, and the administration have specific duties on the basis of the law. In another meeting, I mentioned that these lines must be observed. Things must develop in a way that the administration has its own responsibilities for which it must be answerable. The majlis should be answerable too, so that one can judge its performance. If things get mixed up, it will become difficult to judge. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make our intentions pure. Make what we said, what we did, and what we will say and do serve you and your cause. Dear God, make our hearts brim over with the purity of our actions on your path. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, associate our magnanimous Imam who opened this path to the nation and who brought us to this arena and this path with your prophets and saints. Make his immaculate soul satisfied with us. Make the pure souls of our dear martyrs satisfied with us. Bestow your reward, patience, blessings, and mercy on their families. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school, two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
А где нам жить? Мы здесь, наши дома здесь.
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
Зачем нас обстреливать?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery. While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
Today, the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and the large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid the critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN-brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who want it to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
The Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement, aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it. But to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done. And so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Sharing the same mindset toward the U.S., Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrizas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac's been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts.